Good evening, Current Affairs listeners. My name is Nathan Robertson. I'm the editor of Current Affairs Magazine, and I am here with a tremendously special guest. I am here with a man to whom I sort of owe my entire career for reasons we will get into. I am here with Bhaskar Sankara. He is the publisher of Jacobin Magazine and founder of Jacobin Magazine. He is also the author of the brand new Socialist Manifesto, and I am just thrilled to have him with me today. Bhaskar, hello.
Thank you for having me. That was a fittingly grandiloquent introduction. I don't think I deserve all that, but
I definitely do
appreciate it.
Is I really build people up in the intro so they feel they have to live up to it with sparkling conversation.
Exactly. You are the white Don King, if you will.
Thank you. Nobody has ever called me that before.
I don't think anyone ever will. So this is the first.
Yeah. That's my blurb. When I say, though, that I owe my career to you, what I mean is that you ran a magazine. I think Jacobin was founded, what, 2010, was it?
Yeah, late 2010. It started as an online magazine in like September, October of 2010.
So we started in 2015. So you've been going for 5 years at that point, half a decade, and built something. And I looked at Jacobin and I thought, Jesus Christ, that is impressive. You did a thing that nobody has ever done before, which, or maybe, you know, this might be a little unfair, but you made left media fun and readable and colorful. You know, Jacobin was just so unlike anything else that came before.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that, like, what we tried to do was to take politics that were in many ways very orthodox, throwback Marxist politics, but try to make it vibrant and accessible. And especially the early issues had lots of the fun magazine things, like weird liner copy and things like that. Things I would just come up with by myself, like a few minutes before it was meant to go to press. We have a little bit of that left. I would say the only part of the magazine now where I'm really free to do that stuff is like the section subheadings. I make up some crazy text right before we go to press, and the internet speaks when I get to respond to like our letters or internet comments with sarcastic titles, but there's not a lot of that. So I think I was drawing on influences from like music magazines from the 90s and other things that were not, you know, New Left Review or were not anything like that.
Well, I maintained my complete dictatorial editorial control, so I get to put all the weird shit in Current Affairs still. You've had to be a little professional and respectable in a way.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that the politics is weird enough. Sometimes people don't want to be off-put, but yeah, I think you definitely need to maintain that freedom to be, you know, niche. And I think one of the key lessons that I got was, and I kind of got this from a book, like from like an Irving Howe quote or something like that, not from, you know, anyone in publishing at the time, which is, you know, you kind of create your own audience and you have to kind of live with yourself. So in the long run, the only sustainable thing is to write and publish what you want to see in the world and then hope that the audience comes to you and hope that you're either one, not so weird that you're going to be an audience of one, but also on the other hand, not so generic that you're going to sound like everyone else.
You know, you seem to have thought very carefully all through the process of building Jacobin about balancing pretty cautiously your, I don't want to say this in a way that sounds insulting at all, but like pragmatism and radicalism, like, you know, business-mindedness and a desire to just do whatever the hell you please. And it's interesting because it seems to have worked, but I take it you do think a lot about like, okay, how do we make this viable as a newsstand magazine and not just marginal?
Yeah, but even that, like, initially it was just kind of you trial by error. Like, I had no idea what I was doing, and a lot of the early years was, the goal was to get one subscriber a day almost. You know, I think the goal was just to go from 300-400 to get to 1,000 by the end of the year if you're lucky, and then try to hang on to as many of those people as possible. I would say that today, 8 years in, 8+ years in, I really do know, I think, publishing better than most bourgeois publishers. I know the ins and outs, and I know what I'm doing, but back then I really didn't know. But what was, I still am very ideological, of course, but I was much more of just an ideologue, that I knew the ideas I wanted to propagate in the world. I felt like many people do in their late teens or early 20s, you feel like you have it all figured out. You just need the world to see that this socialism thing is great. You know, obviously in time, you know, your confidence kind of gets rattled a bit because you see how complex and difficult the world and life is. But generally, I think we stuck to that. Like, we have a large staff of like 15, 16 people now. We like to recruit people who are first and foremost ideologues. Then we turn them into writers and journalists, you know, after, rather than starting with clean, polished professionalism and then developing politics. And I think there's a certain feel that attract readers to us, and they wouldn't be attracted to something that was a little bit sleeker than that.
What has been interesting to me about the process of running a small magazine is that, you know, when we started Current Affairs in 2015, the only reason I did it was because I'd seen that you had done it, and I thought, well, you'd sort of proven that it could be done. And I just literally copied everything that you did. Literally. I mean, we hired your printer, Sheridan Press. We hired your web developer, Position Development, and you, I want to say, you have always, and this is something that I love about you, is you've always treated me and us as comrades rather than competitors, which I feel like from the beginning was this real, you didn't have to do that. And I've always respected your kind of willingness to bridge what could be like schisms or rivalries on the left with this real kind of collaborative spirit.
It's like the Fidel Castro thing, which probably isn't a great model for society, but, you know, within the revolution, everything is permitted. Outside the revolution, you know, nothing is permitted. For me, yeah, if I see left-wing media, if I see people doing left-wing projects, I try to be very ecumenical. But then I'm extremely caustic and bitter when it comes to anything that I think like deviates from what I think is a broadly left and egalitarian projects. But, you know, at some point, we're so small and marginal that if it becomes competing over, you know, crumbs, and this goes to left groups too, like then we're just completely, you know, screwed. If like DSA's progress is stifled by Solidarity's progress or whatever else, you know, these other left groups, then, you know, it is very sad because we are very tiny, insignificant parts of a very large country. And we're just at the early stages, I think, of a project to rebuild some sort of democratic left in the U.S.
You also have seemed to take an approach with the content of Jacobin, which is a very ecumenical, big tent approach. I often see, you always get people calling out some Jacobin article going, Jacobin says, you know, this outrageous thing that Jacobin says. Am I wrong in thinking that actually your approach has really been to kind of define a spectrum of what you consider the kind of acceptable range of left views, and then within that have a pretty relaxed approach to the party line?
Yeah, exactly. It's not a line, it's a box. And we obviously have to collectively as editors decide what the box is, what's acceptable, what's not, but we have to allow people to publish within it. Though I think within that box, let's say if it's a scatter plot, right? You could plot out all these variant pieces, but I'm sure you could draw a regression line or whatever it is. Sorry, it's been a while since I took any math course. You could probably see where the dominant thrust of Jackman is when it comes to certain issues and certain things. Like, we have published a few articles by socialists who are not supporting the Bernie Sanders campaign. But it's pretty obvious that the dominant thrust of Jacobin's writers, most of us are supporting Sanders and are supporting him in similar terms. Does that mean we had a meeting beforehand? We decided this? No, it just means that like we're reflecting certain dynamics on the left, but we ourselves are also influencing those dynamics now at this point, given our size. But right now, the print edition, I commission most of and am the primary editor on almost every single print article and everything that goes in the print edition. It's like me and the three designers kind of work on the print editions. The online side, I play a fairly minor role. You know, I read our online content maybe once a week, and I'm in meetings about it maybe once a month, not in the weekly meetings or whatnot. So I think there's a lot of great work being done now by our staff writers and other people online, but that I cannot claim credit for.
Presumably, there have been things that go out in Jacobin that you disagree with, or if there's a thing that you strongly disagree with, would you publish that? I mean, I think about this a lot in terms of like, well, I'm going to be publicly responsible for and am the public face of this organization that's putting out whatever argument, how broadly do I have to be in sympathy with it? Do I have to just at least think that, like, I think the person is committed to coming from a good left place?
Well, yeah, I think for me, the principles are, is it representing the socialist tradition? You know, is it committed to broadly the type of egalitarian politics we believe in? Is it believe in the self-emancipation of working people and so on and so on? And I would say those are my criteria, primarily they're moral ones. But, I mean, we publish around 30 articles a week. By the summer, it'll be 35 articles, original articles a week. You're not going to be able to read, much less agree with all of them. But I think that's the key, to make sure we're not making compromises because we're being bullied, because we're too wedded to, let's say, the trade union bureaucracy, or too wedded to a political campaign, or too wedded to an organization. But in fact, like, each of these are honest decisions. And if there are mistakes, we can deal with it after. I kind of like to let editors and let everyone kind of publish as well. And then if there's systematic underlying problems, then we can kind of address it after. But I guess I've learned to live with that. When it comes to print, I have a much tougher time. If even, like, there's a piece from an activist who's quite prominent and they're very friendly to Jacobin, but they write it, give us like trash copy, like I will either completely rewrite it or reject it, even though I might not online, you know. But in print, it's like, this is for posterity. This is like, as long as you hold everyone to the same standard, that's fine. In general, I think people are much willing to accept aggressive edits for print too. You'd always lie and say it's a layout, you know, or something like that, as opposed to like, you just wrote, you know, 500 words of ideas and 5,000 words, which often happens on the left.
The print is precious. You know, this is going to actually be, it's going to go on coffee tables. I'm a real dictator with the print, but it's not like online. Yeah, whatever. There's room for...
Yeah, and also there needs to be a stage of primitive accumulation. You know, you need to slowly build your audience. That requires a lot of pieces. And Jacobin can maybe be more picky now than we were in the past. In the past, we would run some articles like... We ran an article about, like, not Game of Thrones. We haven't run one of those yet, thank God. We ran an article about, like, Age of Empires or something.
Everyone wants the Marxist take on Game of Thrones, Bosco. When's it coming?
Well, there was one in defense of Wildlings that I thought about commissioning or writing, but I decided that that's just too much jumping the shark for us. But yeah, the in defense of Wildlings was the best Game of Thrones take. Now it's really tough. I don't know. I don't know who to root for now from a Marxist perspective.
What have you learned about being an editor? Because I've made big, big fuck-ups. I've commissioned things and then commissioned art for the things, and then it's turned out that the thing comes in and it's completely different from what I expected, and then you're trying to delicately... Like, there's all this, like, managing relations with people that I didn't expect to be part of being an editor, but it turns out that it's like diplomacy is just a huge part of the editor's job.
Yeah, and also figuring out who to offend, because often by not offending one person, you'll offend someone else. So you have to value certain relationships in the way that an organizer would, or, like, you know, based on like strategy and long-term imperatives and you know, where to position the publication and so on. And also, like, to me, there's nothing that feels better than rejecting a piece from a friend or accepting a piece from someone you personally don't like.
Nothing that feels better?
Yeah, it feels great. It feels like the sense of smug superiority that comes from magnanimity is really incredible. So I honestly, there's plenty of people I don't like that I will edit and publish and promote. It makes me feel good. But if a friend gives me like copy that I don't think is a great fit, I'm actually much more comfortable immediately rejecting it without even much apology. Just because, you know, if you have a personal rapport and relationship with someone, then presumably it shouldn't be affected by something like that. But yeah, a lot of it's like that. And obviously a lot of my time, we have a bunch of staffers, a bunch of people with different, you know, issues, different concerns that are each kind of trying. You have to figure out kind of what people want. Does someone want a job for 1 year and then they're going to be doing some other thing? That's fine. But if you know that, then you know kind of like, here's what we could do and here's what we want you to do and here's how you make your use of that year. If somebody wants to maybe be in a different field or start doing different things or start writing more, just kind of keeping track of all that stuff, which is, I guess, no different than any other form of, like, managing or coordinating things. But it takes on a different valence and different moral importance if it's a left organization, because then people are obviously doing this for a different reason, because if they just were trying to survive, they would have found easier ways to survive than writing and editing on the left. There is that moral imperative. And there's, I think for us, the hardest thing is these international pieces. Sometimes we'll get a 5,000, 6,000 word piece on Indonesia, on Cambodia, and whatever else that will require tons of line editing and the investment of dozens of hours potentially in like fact checking if it's an investigative piece from a different country or whatever else. We can sometimes say no to those pieces, but if it's not being published elsewhere in the Anglophone world, we might have a political imperative to do it. So back when you started Current Affairs, we were doing all that Greek coverage around Syriza. We lost a ton of money. We had very little money at that time on Greek translations, like translations from Greek. But in the long run, it was good for our credibility. And also, more importantly, I think like the Anglophone left needed the source, needed to hear it from somewhere.
Yeah, how do you think about clicks? Because you're a socialist publication, right? But also, you gotta drive the traffic. I mean, I find I'm constantly thinking about this dilemma where I want to write things without any regard to whether anyone wants to read them. I want my process to be purely like, is this important? Should people know this? At the same time, then I think, oh, and then my business brain kicks in and I think, wait a second, but also like, you need to drive the subscribers, because if you drive the subscribers, then you get the money, then you can commission the things that don't bring in the money.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of it, but clicks aren't all created equally. Like, so in the past month, I'm looking at our analytics, we had, I guess, 2 million sessions, 1.5 million users. But our revenue was actually not that great last month. But I suspect that a lot of these clicks were like quick readers from like Reddit or from social media. Maybe some of the articles went viral. I don't know. I didn't actually take a deep dive into it. But, you know, clicks aren't created equal. We have some advertisement, but we're not advertisement sustained. So clicks aren't created equal. Like, if it was just like paid per impression advertisement, then any click matters. But the clicks we actually want are the small percentage of our audience that's going to actually buy this beautiful print magazine. So it's almost like a freemium product or something. So like, if we maintain an audience of 900,000 people, then maybe we could get 3% of them to subscribe to the print edition. And that's how we sustain ourselves. Right around 3-4% of our total online audience buys the print edition. But yeah, it is a very low margin slog, especially at our size. Like, this year we're going to be losing some money, but you know, if the goal was making money, there would be much easier ways to do it.
This is one of the things that amazed me at the beginning is, yeah, you have ads, but very few. I mean, and they're like, what, like a couple of university presses and Verso, mm-hmm. and stuff. You really went for a print subscription driven revenue model, which I think at the time that you did it would have seemed like an insane gamble in 2010, like completely the opposite of the direction in which things were trending. You've been very deliberate in not, for example, pivoting to video. You've really gone hard on, no, we print subscriptions are what's going to drive this revenue.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually the most straightforward business model. Like, there's zero way to make money off digital media at the moment. Essentially, these big companies, like, let's say The Ringer, it's a sports network, like, site. It's like podcasts and web content and videos. But what they do is they invest in all this content, then they build their brand through this video content and so on. Then they get a round of investment. And they're like, oh, now we're worth $15 million in this round because we gained all this traffic. We're a nonprofit. We can't take corporate investment, even if we were structured differently, just because of the nature of our politics and publication. So we actually have to sustain ourselves as we go, which means that, like, even if I can make Jacobin bigger in an unsustainable way through deep discounted subscriptions, through more newsstands, through direct mails, through video, I'd rather the slow approach and thinking about Jacobin at this point as an institution that should hopefully last for 50 years. I think 50 years would be my goal to make it that far.
Well, goodbye then, we'll have, you know, socialism. So 50 years, full communism, everything will be fine. You could probably take a step back and retire.
I think we'll still have a socialist opposition movement in 50 years. So that's that. But I think that's really important that we keep alive ideas and we spread them between generations and so on. And this is kind of a high point of socialist activity and people thinking about it since the 1970s, but there will be many dark, lean years. And I think Jacobin is actually not meant for an era like this. We're meant for the lean times more than anything.
So I just want to get back just, well, I was thinking about all the things that I did because you had successfully pioneered them, and I'm just fascinated by this because you were, you know, you're 21, right, when you found Jacob at 21?
Yes, I was 21, just to turn 21, yeah.
And basically, you are improvising and making it up as, you know, seat of your pants as you go along. The left is, at this point in 2010, pretty dead. This is pre-Occupy Wall Street, even, right?
Yeah, it's pre-Wisconsin uprising, too, I guess. So, yeah, pre a lot of stuff.
And you're trying to not only revive socialism, but as media organizations implode all around you, try and figure out how to make one viable. And I'm just so interested in the Bhaskar of 2010 and the confidence with which he seems to have approached this dilemma.
Yeah, I never had... I did some editing for the blog of the... I was the editor of the blog of the Young Democratic Socialists, kind of DSA's youth section, for a couple years. So I had some limited editing experience, and we didn't do very heavy line editing. I had no publishing experience. So yeah, I kind of learned it as I went along. But I think what really sustained me, especially through the lean years... And actually, I didn't start working full-time for Jacobin until 2015, until early 2015. So I was just doing it, you know, volunteer for the first several years, was, I think, a sense of purpose rooted in politics, right? And it borders on delusion, right? But this sense of purpose, I think, kept alive a lot of the institutions of the left and the core activists and, you know, the people keeping DSA alive and all these other organizations. That was the idea, that at least for me, was, you know, socialism was a revelation. The idea that there was, in fact, a better way out of this needless suffering and misery, the war of all against all that kind of characterize our society today. And I thought, these ideas are so compelling. Just being a part of a movement that is self-consciously going to create the future and a better future. Why aren't these ideas popular? Why aren't they comprehensible? Why, as I dig deeper and deeper into the organizations espousing these ideas, do I find them more and more revolting? You know, so I wanted a publication that would capture some of the vibrancy in life and make it accessible to other people. But then also within the left, it was a left increasingly getting inflected with these like anarchistic thoughts, with what I thought were kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater when it came to the traditional socialist parties and unions and organizations. And I wanted to have an organization that asserted kind of the old politics, updated it where necessary, but still talked about the centrality of class, still talked about all these other things that were common sense in the whole left, every spectrum of the left, up until the 70s and 80s, then very quickly went out of vogue and people were just talking about like multitudes and shit like that. I had both purposes in mind. One was a very positive purpose. One was a, not negative purpose, one was an idea of galvanizing and bringing in new people and hopefully trying to reshape the left in a different direction. And obviously, in small part because of Jacobin, but I think in some part because of Jacobin, things are now pretty good for someone who's intellectually curious and coming to the left. It's a much better era to be a young leftist than it was when I was in high school and college.
One thing I like about both Jacobin and the DSA is that there is this desire to actually win and to look at the past, not to LARP the past and roleplay and reenact our heroic revolutionary ancestors' struggle, but to take what is good and discard what didn't work, and to be pretty ruthless in saying, what are some of the lessons here that we needed to learn? And in fact, just to touch on your new book, The Socialist Manifesto, it is a manifesto for the principles of socialism, but it is also a look at revolutionary movements of eras past and an attempt to figure out what should we take and what lessons should history teach us.
It was not meant to be a manifesto. My original title was Socialism in Our Time. And then the publisher, Basic Books, which was otherwise extremely generous with inviting me to write the book, keeping the content intact, which is quite radical content for kind of a mainstream press like that, they were just like, that's not going to sell. We need a new title. Immediately, someone from their team came up with, how about The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality? Then I'm like, wow, it's a really long subtitle. And they're like, yeah, that's really useful for like Amazon and other Google searches. People type in inequality and the book will come up. Then I'm like, all right, that's logical. We'll keep the subtitle. Then I just couldn't deny that The Socialist Manifesto was going to sell more copies than Socialism in Our Time. So me as a writer, took a backseat to me as a publisher, so I just went with it. But essentially, you know, the first part of the book is meant to be a vision of what socialism could look like. It was meant to not be a case against capitalism, but an affirmative case, a day in the life of a social citizen. The middle part is this kind of history that, as you say, kind of takes a critical look at both the highs and lows of the socialist tradition. And I tried to avoid the no true Scotsman dilemma, which is very similar to when you talk to libertarians and you start talking about how bad capitalism is to them. They might say, yeah, but that's not real capitalism. That's
cronyism.
That's crony capitalism, yeah. And it's just such a cop-out. So when someone talks about to me about the Soviet Union, I don't say, oh, that's not real socialism or whatever. I say, yeah, that was a bad authoritarian form of socialism. Here's how it became that way, and here's why we could do it differently. And that's what those middle chapters try to do. And then at the end, I guess the final third of the book, you might actually call something like a manifesto. It updates us to the emergence of Sanders and Corbyn. It talks about what lessons should we draw from the extensive history of socialism in the past 150 years. It ends on a bit of a slightly utopian note about what our future society could look like.
You know, I've always taken the approach you hate here, where I've always gone, well, you know, authoritarianism shouldn't get to claim to be socialism, because if socialists are about freedom, then we shouldn't let people who don't advance the thing that we say we believe in lay claim to the label. But, I mean, is authoritarian socialism a contradiction?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think one could put it as there are different types of collectivism possible, right? And one is an authoritarian collectivism, which was born out of scarcity that you saw arise in Russia and in China and some of these other countries. It was an authoritarianism that wasn't rooted in the desire to be evil and violent, but rooted in the desire to quickly develop backward countries and to catch up with the West and to bring these largely peasant societies into modernity. Then you could say then there's different strands of the socialist tradition that might not go to our level of what we believe in when we say socialism. Like, when I say socialism, I mean worker control of the means of production. I mean all these other things that weren't actually the case when Western European socialist parties or even in places like Sweden took power. They instituted broad welfare states, and many of them even dropped the horizon of that kind of socialism. But they have the same common ancestor in the broad-based workers' movements of the 19th century. And many of those parties call themselves socialists. So I think we should examine and understand it as part of the socialist tradition, while, of course, holding out for our vision of a radically, you know, emancipatory society.
What do you think are some of the important things that today's socialists need to keep in mind or learn in order to avoid the worst tendencies or the most self-destructive tendencies of socialist movements past?
Right. So I think from the more revolutionary socialist tradition that ended up kind of devolving into Stalinism in the Eastern Bloc, I think we should just learn the importance of maintaining a free civil society, and how even if we compromise from those values when it seems like it's just out of necessity or it seems like it's just going to be short term, we'll in fact create the conditions in which it'll be very easy for a new caste of bureaucrats and others to arise and to institute new forms of oppression to replace the old ones. So I think it's as simple as trying to, even in very difficult conditions, maintain democracy and maintain a free civil society. Also, maybe in the same way, being prepared to wait and slowly consolidate a majority, even if it's difficult. But I think a lot of what you saw in the Soviet Union was compounded by just the fact that forms of democracy that existed in the early years of the Soviet Union were extinguished by the mid to late 1920s, and that really paved the way for Stalin's consolidation of power. In the West, I think we need to remember, when it comes to the tradition of Western European social democracy, that the state indeed has a class bias. Even if the state is a democratic state, even if it's run by self-described socialists, the state itself will be financed from the taxation of productive enterprises. The whole economy works because capitalists are able to maintain profitability and because they're able to expand their production. That's an economy under capitalism. So you're not just administering a state, you're not just filling a state, you're running a capitalist state. And if you want to think about radically transforming society beyond just instituting a small welfare state or even an expansive welfare state, you have to start thinking about getting rid of the power of capital to withhold investment. Because as soon as they see their profitability be cut a little bit, they'll just say, all right, you know, we had enough, you know, we're going to roll back this social democratic compromise. So I think if we don't understand the nature of the state and we don't take that lesson from the Leninist tradition, we're going to have a hard time going beyond capitalism. So in other words, Leninists were right that the state was a capitalist state. They were maybe wrong about how we get rid of that capitalist state and advance Western democracies. You know, I don't think there's an insurrectionary route to getting rid of the state, but I do think that a party with a majority needs to start eroding and dismantling it from within.
Socialists have always had a number of ideological divides. There's the Marxist-anarchist divide, and I take it you're much more on the Marxist side of that. But I've always found that there are sort of valuable critiques that I think should be borne in mind that come out of that more anarchist tradition, like a skepticism of the power of bureaucracy to entrench itself, a real radical commitment to preserving freedom and being sort of almost paranoid about making sure that you're not rationalizing or excusing atrocities or things that end in bloodshed and nightmare. I mean, you know, some people might...
Yeah, I don't think that just comes from the anarchist tradition, though. I mean, I think all those critiques come from different strands of the socialist tradition. It comes from even Trotskyism, some of the critiques of bureaucracy, both in trade unions and in parties. You know, there's a radical democratic critique of Luxembourg and Liebknecht, who ended their lives as kind of revolutionary
right.
socialists,
yeah,
almost the Leninist, you know, variety. So,
which is in your book, yeah.
Yeah, I think, in other words, a class struggle anarchism that arose in Western Europe and in Russia, throughout Europe, Mexico and elsewhere, Cuba, throughout the early 20th, throughout the late 19th century, was in fact a radical working class movement that had a lot of these similar insights to other working class movements. If we were talking about, you know, the anarchists of Spain in the 1930s, I'd be with a lot of those anarchists. Anarchism today, though, is completely detached from a class base. All it is pure moralism. It's a very much a middle-class movement. So I take intellectual inspiration from the old anarchists. I'm just more skeptical whether there's a future for anarchism as a current of thought today.
Can I ask you about the word moralism? Because I hear the word moralism a lot. I never quite understand. Maybe you could explain it to me, because, like, I feel very moralistic. I feel like a lot of my critiques are very strong, and people I get criticized as moralistic, but I never quite understand what the critique of moralism is. I guess mere moralism I understand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it feels to me like a lot of where we come from is grounded in sort of sincere moral outrage, and I don't quite know how to put it differently.
I think you're completely right, and this is a point that I draw from Eric Olin Wright and others, and I guess I break from certain Marxists, in that, you know, we can say we're scientific socialists, but at the end of the day, our politics only makes sense if we have a normative opposition to exploitation and hierarchy. We believe that wage labor constitutes a form of exploitation and a form of hierarchy and domination that's unacceptable. Otherwise, our politics doesn't make sense unless you have that starting point, because, you know, there's certainly people who think that certain extreme forms of exploitation are bad. Like most capitalists today, even Donald fucking Trump isn't for slavery. You know, he thinks that chattel slavery is probably an extreme form of exploitation. So when we say that we draw a line here and we're trying to construct a society without this thing, without the exploitation of person by person, whatever else, that's a moral judgment. And it's rooted in nothing else. It doesn't have a scientific basis. It's not rooted in, oh, capitalism's a fetter on the development of productive forces, therefore it must be overcome. No, it's a moral thing. That's our starting point. When I think about moralism, I think about a set of very personal, individualistic stances and outrages, where you take that instead of saying, therefore I'm a part of this working class movement, this agent of change, potential agent of change, and I believe in kind of collective solutions to the problem. You're basically saying that, like, I say no, I reject, you know, I don't stand for this. And also you're not willing to take your personal stances and meld it in a broader collective project in which it can get, you know, messier, in which there might need to be more enforced discipline and organization within certain reasonable bounds. I would say, yeah, you do have a trend to your writing that's like very like in the tradition of like ethical socialism, which, I mean, it's kind of non-Marxian in certain ways. I wouldn't call it moralistic. I don't even mean that in a bad way, but...
Do you think being a socialist does entail certain responsibilities as an individual? Is there a socialist ethic or attitude to life? How should socialism apply in your relations with your fellow human beings? Does it mean that you're a person who is compassionate and generous, or does it just mean that you have to go to the meetings and be part of the movement?
I think one should go to meetings. I mean, I myself have probably only been to three socialist... I'm averaging less than one a month when it comes to DSA stuff. this year, but you know, I was very active for many years.
Your life is one big meeting.
Like, yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. No, honestly, I need to go home and watch TV. You know, I need to do things that don't involve the left and don't involve, you know, thinking. But yeah, I would say we have a responsibility to get active and get involved. And for those of us who are in the professional classes, I think we have a responsibility to get engaged where we can in things like a local tenants union and figure out how we can be useful and how we can get rooted. And more importantly, raise the level of class consciousness when it comes to existing struggles. So, for example, if you're involved in a feminist struggle, a socialist response wouldn't be, don't take part in this because it's a middle class effort. A socialist response would be like, how do we raise the level of class consciousness? How do we organize within this broader movement? But more broadly, I mean, I think that how to be a good socialist from an ethical personal standpoint is just not be a dick. It's how to be a good human being, to be empathetic, to not assume you have the right answers. And especially today, I think the left, to be a good organizer on the left means to ask more questions than you're giving answers, because we don't know more about people's lives than they do. And especially because the left is so weak and fragmented, the best way, instead of us just canvassing around a set of demands in a neighborhood, I think it's really important for us to go out, ask people questions, listen to them, and follow what people are saying about what their concerns are and what faces them and how politics can maybe help them. So I think asking questions and whatnot. But, you know, as far as even, like I say, my personal life, you know, I watch a lot of NBA. I hang out with my friends, most of whom are not on the left.
Shocking percentage of your social media output is about basketball.
Yeah, you know, I have a kind of a normcore life in certain ways. But, you know, you try to be nice to people and you try to treat people the right way. And that's just not being a dick. You know, that's not being a socialist. You know?
Oh, I have another question I've always wanted to ask you. Do you think Bernie Sanders is a socialist? Is he lying when he says he's the democratic socialist? Is it fair to say, you know, I wrote a thing a while back that said that, I now look back on it as very unfair, where I said either Bernie Sanders did not understand what it means to be a democratic socialist, or he is misleading people about it. Do you think that is fair, or do you think that it is acceptable for him to classify himself as a socialist considering what he's actually advocating?
No, Bernie Sanders is absolutely a socialist. There's
really
zero question about it in
really?
my mind.
This is so
zero,
contested.
Zero. So yeah, Bernie Sanders joined the dying remnants of the Socialist Party, its youth wing, when he was in college. He then spent the preceding decade, or the decade that followed, doing civil rights organizing, labor organizing, other efforts. Then he went to Vermont. He fucked off for a couple of years, like a lot of people in that generation did. They were just kind of out there, you know, walking barefoot outside in the fucking dirt, or whatever the fuck these crazy white new leftists were doing. Then he started getting engaged in politics again. And when he got engaged in politics, he joined a left-wing independent party. He was palling around with the Socialist Workers Party in the 70s and 80s. He was doing Cuba and Central America solidarity stuff. He became a left-wing mayor. He ran as an independent, not as a Democrat. And he continued calling himself socialist throughout the 90s. You know, so he has this legacy and this tradition. And when he talks about politics and he talks about the world, you could actually hear his background, the way he was trained. He talks about the millionaires and billionaires. He talks about, well, nowadays he just talks about the billionaires ever since they outed him as a fucking millionaire. He talks about those who have and how they're responsible for a lot of the exploitation, a lot of the problems that people who don't have. It's a class polarization. And his demands are class struggle demands. They're demands for redress from both capitalists and from the state in the interest of working people. So to me, it's perfectly compatible with demands and a worldview coming from the socialist movement.
Do you think he's just being a little careful then in the way that he phrases it when he is asked these days, as he tries to become president, what it means to be a socialist? Because he said, I'm not sure that he would say the class struggle if he was asked. And, you know, the big criticism is, well, yeah, but everything he's advocating right now is consistent with what Franklin Roosevelt would want. And Alex Coburn used to criticize.
It's not true, actually. The things he's advocating are not consistent with what Roosevelt would want at all. I mean, Roosevelt was the leader of a capitalist coalition that included working people. He tried to reconcile the two's demands. So what was the most important part of Roosevelt's coalition? Yes, the labor unions were important, but it was also big oil. big oil is capital-intensive industries. They could deal with big labor demands. They were part of the Democratic Party tent. Roosevelt was able to use some of the mass mobilizations, use the union movement in the 30s, use whatever else to push through his agenda. But fundamentally, it was about expanding a welfare state to shore up capitalism. Today, capital is doing fine. Capital in the U.S. is actually quite productive. It's completely profitable. It's recovered from the dip a decade ago. What Sanders is proposing is taking some of the wealth that capitalism is producing and giving it back to the workers that are getting unfairly compensated, and also building a redistributive welfare state. It is different, and the method is different. The goal is different. And we're in an era when capitalists seem less willing than ever to actually give up things and cave to our demands. So it's going to mean confrontation. So I think that Sanders is far better than even Olof Palme and the Social Democrats of Europe, given the context, much less FDR, who's someone that I wouldn't have voted for in the 1930s in that context.
You must think a lot about the strategy for how you actually get more than just a Sanders presidency. I mean, I see the route to a Sanders presidency as pretty clear and pretty plausible at this point. I mean, I thought it was plausible in 2016, but the critique that is always made is, yeah, but how do you keep that from being completely impotent? And then how do you get, and then the worst possible thing that could happen is that you have a democratic socialist president who is then not able to advance a democratic socialist agenda and then discredits the left for a generation. That would be horrible.
No, I don't think that'll be a huge problem at all. Sanders will get elected and he will try to do what he can through the bully pulpit of the office, through executive orders. He'll try to galvanize a majority in Congress to try to pass certain legislation. He will likely fail, as you suggest. But he'll use the bully pulpit and blame the failure on corporate Democrats, on Republican obstruction, on whatever else. You know, we won't have the egg on our face. People will think that he's an earnest, honest presidency. We'll be able to do certain things on the margins. Yeah, hopefully we'll have to push him to do certain things by executive order. But I do think that we can normalize having both a socialist in the White House and having a socialist extra-parliamentary movement. I mean, I keep saying we, but in my view, once Sanders is in office, we really need to think about the left as, you know, an independent force that shouldn't be hostile to Sanders, but really needs to think of itself as you know, free of him.
Well, I mean, that sort of brings me to what I kind of want to end on here, which is to go back to your project as a mogul and thinking about the role of left media. I take it to you, Jacobin is an instrument. It is a tool. It is something that is designed to move forward a left agenda. And it's also the case that I think there are people on the left who don't necessarily think about using words and persuasion and speech in ways that move forward left politics. But you do think a lot about the power of media and why it's important and how to get it and how to use it as a component of overall political strategy. So what is the role of left media organizations like yours?
The goal is they should ideally be political centers. They should be places where people are airing ideas, relating to ideas, that there are kind of informal tendencies being created around ideas and currents of thoughts, but there's also competing current of thoughts. You know, so I think the goal of a publication has to be to educate and speak to debates that are happening, and make sure people are informed, not only about debates within the left, but also about the world at large. For example, it might be very convenient for us to say that things are terrible under Trump and people are suffering from joblessness. Meanwhile, unemployment's actually going down. So how do we actually, in other words, we need a publication that can explain things that are going on empirically, explain why workers are still getting screwed as the economy seems to get better. And that requires a degree of literacy in economics, and not just kind of commentary and snarking about the latest thing that just happened on Twitter or on social media or some celebrity or whatever else. So I think being a step removed from politics is really important. And ultimately, the outsized role of publications on the U.S. left shouldn't last for long. Ideally, we'll have large enough organizations with their own publications, but more importantly, with their own channels of internal debate, large enough roots with the working class movement, that these things are actually being shaped by parties and organizations and not by outside media outlets that by their nature can't be really accountable to anything. Like, Jacobin, I think, should be an independently run editorially, maybe, but it should be an organ of a party. It shouldn't be this free-floating thing. And, of course, the party would have to be a democratic one rooted in a class. But to me, like, Left Media is just a temporary thing we're using to expand the profile of the socialist movement, but it can't be, you know, it's almost pernicious, the fact that we play this large of a role and, you know, we don't have much of a real mass movement in the U.S.
And I guess I just want to end by asking you what you've learned over the course of this nearly 10-year now project in terms of how you have studied how the bourgeois press run. You have learned all their tips and techniques, and you have absorbed all of their... You know how the game is played. You've learned how to play it, and you're trying to beat them at it. And what have you learned over the course of that as to how we do this?
Yeah, I think nobody knows what they're doing anymore. Honestly, like, when it comes to digital media, online media, like, people come in, and I occasionally do, like, an hour or two of consulting for a large media company. And, like, you have these young kids with, like, marketing degrees that, like, literally don't know how to read a balance sheet or whatever else, but they know words like ideation and, like, you know, brand impact and, like, all this other fucking word salad or whatever. So I think nobody knows what they're talking about. The ruling class isn't actually that smart. They're just the people who chose a different route and a far more expedient route. But at the end of the day, creating a really large newspaper, that kind of publication is difficult. Creating a fairly niche, fairly low volume magazine is pretty easy. You know, it's a country of 330 million people. Jacobin has 36,000 subscribers. Like, that's not a great percentage. Yeah, I guess if the bar is this low, you could say that it is pretty easy. I think that the thing is, publications like Current Affairs, like Jacobin, can play a disproportionate impact because of how open the political field is right now. People are hungry for ideas. They're looking to get engaged in some sort of politics. They're looking for a project that they could be a part of. The same thing with AOC. It's like one person and a handful of staffers volunteering their time could end up being this international phenomenon. People are looking for answers, and especially in our generation, I think they're looking for good answers. If they wanted racism, if they wanted xenophobia, they would have jumped on the Trump bandwagon in 2015 and 2016. They didn't, and we're here to fill this void. But I wouldn't say I really know much about publishing compared to others, if not for the fact that, like, yeah, just nobody knows how to do these things anymore, because there's legacy publications that have been around for a really long time, then there's these new online media publications that are just funded by, you know, whatever, Saudi Arabian, you know, oil money. Then there's, like, us, but our successes are fairly limited in the grand scheme of things. Like, we could start selling knives door-to-door, and I guarantee you our margins would be better.
You know, I found exactly the same thing, that it was easier than I thought, because you don't actually need that many subscribers in order to be sustainable at a low level. And it is the case that there's really so many... This is 2016 was a huge revelation for me, because I was like, oh, nobody knows what they're doing. This is great. Like, I know more than half the people who make their living making political predictions.
Yeah, or even, like, social media managers. The idea that, like, all these, like, publications have, like, three people having social media strategy and branding meetings and figuring out how to boost their engagement, where I'm sure the Current Affairs Twitter feed runs like the Jacobin Twitter feed, which is just kind of people randomly tweet things from time to time, you know, and it works better.
No, absolutely. Let's end on that lovely optimistic note, because it tells people you can do it.
Or that we're better than everyone else, right?
We're better than everyone else and socialism will win.
Of course.
Well, thank you so much, Bhaskar, and everyone should pick up your brand new book, The Socialist Manifesto.
You could buy it at Powell's or at another good union retailers. And I don't get any of my royalties. Unlike my man Bernie Sanders, you know, my royalties are getting donated to Jacobin and to a couple other socialist organizations. So please do get a copy.
And you have another book. Didn't you edit another book?
Yeah, I've edited books before. This is my first real one, so I need the scans. I just want a mainstream press to let me write another book. That's why I'm hawking these sales. But I'm lucky enough to get a meager but sustainable salary from Jacobin, so I'm all good otherwise.
And I think people who pick up The Socialist Manifesto will be surprised at how non-dry it is. If you'd asked me to place money on whether John Bon Jovi would have appeared in the first sentence, I would have said no. And yet...
Yes, thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. Current Affairs has been great. And yeah, my hair is better than yours, I think, but my prose is not as good as yours, so that's high praise coming from you.
All right, well, thank you so much, Bosco. I really appreciate getting to
All right, take care. All right, later.